Welcome to the Smart Brand Marketing Podcast with your host, Tom the Digital Architect Liebelt. Are you tired of spending money on marketing efforts that produce little or no results? Unable to decide whether internet marketing is right for your business? Want to take your brand to the next level but are unsure of what steps to take next? Hey, you're not alone. Join thousands of others in their pursuit of growing a profitable business and learning actionable strategies on how they can outperform brands that are older, bigger, and stronger.
Hey, what's up, buddy?
Tom, what's up, man?
Finally, we've been trying to do this recording for a year and a half now, I think.
Yeah, it's been a long time coming.
You've become a big boss now since then.
Trying my best, you know?
You definitely got the hand motions down. I was going to ask you about that because it seems like you learned them from somewhere because they were very, not really like automatic, but like when you finished a sentence and when you did different things, your hands moved in a certain way. It was like something like someone taught you that, like an acting class or something.
Definitely haven't done any classes. I think it's just like a natural thing. I will say this, I would like to go to like some classes eventually once I hit like the speaker thing harder sometime in the future and really improve on that, because if I've learned anything, you know, if you have any kind of natural ability, unfortunately, like I got skipped on that with like most sports and shit, you should pursue it.
I think so. And, you know, a lot of people, well, James Franco, for example, he took acting classes, and I know a couple other people that did too, speakers. And also, comedy improv classes. I've been hearing a lot of good about that. I mean, I'm in Europe now, and I was in Southeast Asia, so I can't really take comedy improv here. It wouldn't make sense. But when I'm back in the States, I'm thinking of doing it. Just, you know, to improve the, I guess, being in the flow. I think it'll be good for podcasting, speaking, anything, just to get that momentum in and be able to always say yes and something else. And hopefully it's funny.
I think so. No, I think you're definitely right.
I've been thinking, how do I want to handle this interview? Because there's a lot of different places where I could start. And you can correct me if I'm wrong on some of this, because I remember, I think 2 years ago, it was summertime and you got stuck. Like you didn't know what business you were going to do, I think. Was it 3 years ago? I know you quit your job and then you were in a little like a weird spot.
Yeah, we can go there. That is going to be like 2012, 2013. It's going to be early 2013.
Yeah, I think it's a good starting point because it was a moment where you had a good degree, right? And I don't know if you were in a good job or you were about to get a good job, but you quit it.
Yeah.
Yeah. What made you do that?
I think the big thing was working at the first startup. I really thought that, you know, I'm going to get a good job. I'm going to get paid well. I'm just going to go in there for whatever hours, cash my check, and just be a drone and really enjoy my time. But what I realized was if I'm not doing work that's fulfilling, I'm just not going to be happy.
That's a hard one, though, especially for someone like me that hustles most of the time. And it's usually the wife that's saying, like, does this really make sense? Does this make you happy? And it's not something I would think of normally, right? It's like, well, I'm selling things, right? I got to sell. But at the end of the day, yeah, it's the fulfilling thing, I think. The happiness levels are definitely different.
Absolutely. You know, I was in a position where everything was good, but, you know, I just felt like I wasn't creating enough. I wasn't living up to my potential. And when you have that kind of conversation with yourself, there are a lot of ways that you can take it. You know, some people will do the thing where they're like working on their projects at night or doing this or whatever it might be. I'm the type of person, and I recognize how much I like to procrastinate and things like that, that I need to push myself to the edge. That if the edge isn't there, you know, I won't perform my best because I'll get lazy.
When someone quits their job, and I think, you know, that's like a kind of touchy subject right now with the whole quitting your job and starting a business. It's like this could go in 10 different ways, and I don't even know if I would recommend it to most people. But when you when you quit your job, how do you decide what to do next? I mean, what did you do? Because I think that's a big problem, because people jump into this world and it's like, okay, I quit my job. I'm going to start a business. What's my business?
Sure. Let's backtrack a little bit. I've got startup experience before that. Did 3 years at a company called giftcardrescue.com as the first employee. So I like to think that I had some internet skills, you know, prior to quitting. So it's not like I'm just some guy who read like the 4-hour work week, although I did, that just wanted to quit and like, you know, go drink coconuts with people on the beach, whatever it might be. You know, I had skills and I had a music blog that I sold this year. It's called WhiteRaverRafting.com. It was all about electronic music. We started it before, like, electronic really blew up in the U.S. So I did have a modest amount of income coming in through there, and I could get, you know, various consulting deals or whatever it might be. But when I quit, I just realized that, you know, I have to do something different. I have to do something more. And I didn't want to get locked down to, you know, thinking about things like whether it's a pension or my 401k. It's like, man, I need to be out there hustling. I need to be out there grinding now. And that's what I did.
Yeah, the 401k, all the boring stuff. When did you start the music blog? Were you in the startup or did you start that afterwards?
I was still working for the startup then. It was kind of like something I would do in my spare time. And it really started like a lot of projects that end up getting bigger. You know, I just wanted to share this awesome music, you know, that I was listening to with my friends. Back then, like, everything, all the music was free because electronic was really like a fringe thing. And after I went to Ultra Music Festival 2011 or 2012, I was like, wow, you know, this thing is going to be so big. I need to commit more resources and time to it. One of my best friends, his name's Wade, he's working, doing awesome things in the music industry now. So he like came on board and helped me. And, you know, at the peak, we would do anywhere from 400 to 500,000 unique visitors a month.
That's big. How would you guys monetize an electronic music blog?
Monetizing anything like that is going to be challenging when you're looking at a niche audience, especially in music, because, you know, as you know, there's not a ton of money going around. The artists are starving.
Yeah.
Only certain people are making money. But we were able to strike different advertising deals with whether it's clubs, festivals, or things like that, and then geo-target the ads based on where they were. So if there was a festival going on in San Diego, we would target all of our ads space that we were selling to everyone coming in from the West Coast. They'd see the ad, and once we got to, you know, however many views, you know, we get paid on a CPM basis. Or sometimes, if we could do a deal with a bigger ad network, you know, they would do an entire sellout for where you get like the entire site skin. So you have like all three ads and you'll have like the takeover thing in the background. And when that was really good in the good days, we could do anywhere from like a 20 to like a 40 something dollar CPM because it was like extremely targeted traffic. And we would just have like an all hands on deck day, pump out like 50 articles and, you know, just try and push as many people to the site as possible because those were the opportunities for us to make money.
How much did you work back then?
I think I've always been working probably too much. That really hasn't ever changed.
What's your routine like then? I think that'll be interesting.
Routine's interesting. So my last apartment, I had like nice blackout curtains in the bedroom. And I'd wake up a little bit later and stay up to like, you know, 2 or 3, sometimes even 4 working. And now I moved into a new place here in Austin that's got like the floor to ceiling windows, and at like 7 in the morning, it's bright. So I've been waking up earlier. I'll go to work, which my office is right down the street. I'll grind for a while, usually come back to my apartment for lunch or something, try and get done some of my creative stuff, the stuff that I feel like really, you know, moves the business and my projects forward. You know, after that, I'll go back into the office. I'll hit a workout with a good crew of people here in town. Shout out to AppSumo and Sumo Me. And then I will, you know, I'll come back home, either work, read, sometimes play some video games till 1 or 2 again. So it's not that much different, but the 4, 5, 6 a.m. mornings, they're gone now.
You know, I want to sidetrack a little bit since you mentioned Austin. How is Austin and how does it compare to Southeast Asia? Because I know it's a big thing in the startup community now, but when I think of it, a lot of the creatives back in like 2000 and 90 something, they actually moved to Austin back then. It just recently became a huge startup thing. I'm curious, how do you see it?
Austin is an incredible town, mainly because of the culture of everyone here. Everyone's really trying to push forward in whatever endeavors they might have, and they're very open. So it's like everyone's accessible. If you need help with, you know, marketing campaigns, you need help with product sourcing, you need help with your listings on Amazon, whatever it might be, all of those things are really available to you. and available to you quickly. It's been amazing for me here personally, and then for my business as well, because we've just been able to meet so many intelligent people that have really helped us push the needle forward.
But how do you compare it to, let's say, Southeast Asia? Because that was a big thing for a while too, right? Just pack your bags, quit your job, fly to Vietnam or something. So I'm curious how I have my own feelings on Southeast Asia, but I'm curious how you feel and how you compare it to Austin.
I think Asia was amazing, and it was a good place for me to be for a while to kind of explore and to figure out if long-term travel was something that, you know, I wanted to pursue. And what I realized personally is that, you know, I'm interested in working and growing my businesses now more so than, you know, pursuing the lifestyle of that a lot of people have out there. And people out there crush it too. So ultimately, I think it kind of depends on where you are with your goals, where you are with your business, and how your skills are. You know, if you're trying to get a bunch of development work done and, you know, start building some apps or something like that, you know, Asia is the place to be because, you know, you can pay someone significantly less and they'll do just as good a job as, you know, someone here in the States. But where I am in the products world, I need to be here with my customers. And what's incredible is a lot of them are actually here in Austin.
Yeah, I feel like Southeast Asia is really good to get ideas flowing and just to get outside the box a little bit. But if you want to actually come and grow the business and really hustle, it's kind of better to do it in the States. At least that's the way I feel, especially if, like you said, the customers are in the States. Plus, like you said, you can meet a lot of really smart people really close to you, especially if you're like in Austin or San Francisco or maybe even New York. But New York wasn't really that big on the startup scenes when I remember it.
Yeah, I also like being around wealth. So it's like you'll be walking around, you'll see, you know, Tesla's all over the place and things like that. And maybe I don't necessarily want that right now, but seeing that and knowing that, like, you can keep leveling up to that material things or whatever it might be. I mean, that's important for me to see, to be around, because if you're in a place where you can live for very cheap and have a high quality of life, then for me, the motivation is less. And I always need to be in a place where, you know, I'm motivated more to work by my surroundings.
I think the apartment prices in Austin are motivating you a little bit too.
The apartment prices here are expensive. Austin is not cheap. Anyone listening out there who keeps seeing like, oh yeah, move here, blah, blah, blah. It is an amazing place, but it is not a cheap town.
It's definitely not. It used to be cheap. I remember hearing an episode with Mike Judge when he moved out there in the 90s, and he said it was really cheap, really nice, nothing but creatives. But these days, when the startups came in, and like you said, the Teslas and things, oh man, it's a different ballgame.
Once all the tech companies started coming in, all the salaries went up. I live in a newer apartment building here in Austin, and I was downstairs at the pool when it first opened up, and I think like 9 out of 10 people were like engineers for all the big companies and stuff. I was like, wow, that's what's happening here.
That's cool. So let's backtrack a little bit. So you had a music website. You sold it now, but in between there somewhere, you started a new company.
Yeah.
Which had to do with supplements. So I'm curious, where'd you get that idea and why did you move away from the music into that?
Well, I always like to start things or do things to see if that's what I really want. And starting the music blog was a way for me to step closer into that world. And I got awesome experiences, you know, being able to meet all the artists, you know, photograph, take photos as press for all these events, you know, interview them, do all the behind the scenes stuff. And what I realized was that, you know, ultimately that's not the direction that I wanted my career to go into. And the same thing was really with Asia. It's like, do I want to travel, you know, long term? Do I want to do that for a while? And I went for a couple months and was like, met some amazing friends, but realized like, you know, I need to be here grinding. So the transition really happened with, I was doing some consulting on the side as well and ended up working for my now partner, getting him ready to sell one of his other supplement, you know, brands that he had owned. And from there, we kind of, you know, had a really great working relationship and started exploring other opportunities to work together on a bigger project.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about this working with partners thing, because I've had some mixed results when I've done it. And it seems like you've worked on both of these projects with partners. So I'm just trying to get your take on that.
I think with partnerships, the number one most important thing is communication. I think second to that is only having your goals aligned. And I say this whenever I get interviewed, whenever I talk to anyone, is that, you know, I'm very lucky in the relationship that I have, is that both of our goals are aligned. You know, we want to take over this industry, we want to change this industry, and we want to help people, you know, all over the world. All of things we're accomplishing, you know, slowly and steadily. But partnerships can be one of the most challenging things, because if you see differently on certain goals and certain visions for the company, and then that doesn't get communicated well, then everything can just break apart like that. And it's even worse, in my opinion, if your partner's with someone you have a previous relationship with. Have you experienced that at all?
Yeah, I have. I had one partnership with a previous coworker, and that didn't work out well. Then I had a partnership with someone I just met, and we were aligned with our goals, and that worked completely different.
The thing with working with someone that you have a previous relationship with is that automatically you're going to go back to like certain events where, you know, maybe they eventually said you were right, or you're going to go back to your past constantly. And because of that, you're not going to bring things up that you would with someone brand new to kind of tell them how you feel, because maybe you think they're going to understand, or however it might work. For anyone listening out there, I think it's extremely challenging to work with people that you feel comfortable with, because when things get bad, when things get rocky, you know, it might all just fall apart.
It's like saying if you're in a room and you're the smartest guy in the room, it's the wrong room.
Well, I'm alone in the room right now, so.
Well, no, if you just go into a meeting, right? And or like a meetup or something, and if you're the smartest guy there, it's the wrong place to be.
No, you're exactly right. And that's what I've really been learning about growing my company. I was talking with Eric Bandholz the other day. He's a DC guy as well. And we're just talking about growing both of our consumer brands and just realizing that, you know, we really need to focus and shift kind of our mindsets to hiring people that are way smarter than us in different areas, whether it's, you know, digital marketing, social media stuff, whatever it might be.
So how has that been going? Have you been able to make some hires like that? Because that's a really challenging thing of getting someone smarter than you on your team. I think that's a whole mind shift of its own.
Oh, absolutely. It's a mind shift and kind of evolution as an entrepreneur, realizing that in order for you to grow the business, you need to not disconnect, but step back a little bit and bring in, you know, super intelligent people that can kind of follow your vision, but then also implement on their own and bring their own ideas. Yesterday, we hired someone, experienced sales guy in the industry, very excited about bringing him in and what that means for the team and what that means for kind of that division or department of our business. It's a little bit scary because it's not someone that we can necessarily like come in and mold and say like, hey, this is my process. I want you to follow it to a T, because it's worked, you know, at this level. It's more so this person's like, I've done it all before. I've had this many accounts and done millions and millions of dollars in revenue. So we're like, okay, you know, we'll kind of let you go and just facilitate and support as much as you need.
Yeah, as long as the sales guy is not your first employee or the one that's doing all the selling, you should be okay. But if he is, that's a problem.
Yeah, no, not our first employee. We have, I think, five now that are full-time. And then, of course, like any other business, employ a variety of different contractors. If you're listening, I'm always looking for really good marketing people. But you have to come live here in Austin where it's hot and eat a lot of tacos and drink beer.
How hot is it in Austin?
Sometimes it hasn't been that hot this year. I think last summer was a lot hotter, but you know, I like to say it kind of gets like hell hot where you just like walk outside and you start getting fire on your arms and stuff. It's not like Southeast Asia, like humid or anything like that. It's just like hot, like death.
Is it like Vegas?
Yeah, it's that dry Vegas heat.
Oh, but
I think the sun here like melts you a little bit more than Vegas. But then I'm also like not in that Vegas mindset here, so.
Well, no, the thing about Vegas that I just always remember, because I used to go to some Muay Thai fights out there, is that when you, that furnace heat just like, it just gets you right in the face when you come out the door. Like, it's just this weird feeling, and it's really dry too, but it's like opening a furnace. It was really hot.
Yeah, so it's basically like that here.
Ouch.
Not right now, but most of the time.
At least the winter should be good.
It's surprising, actually, and I think Peter Keller told me this. It's like, yeah, it gets cold here during the winter, and dude, this is my first one. And yeah, I mean, you had to wear a jacket and stuff.
So with Natural Stacks, how would you guys start out? Did you start with just one product? Did you start with a whole line? Because I usually hear just to start with one thing, grow it, and then expand. So I'm just curious on your strategy.
We started with two products. And the main reason we did that is the first one, Siltep, was already out there. You know, a lot of people were taking it, and we decided to put the entire formula into a single capsule. Ended up linking with the creator, Abelard Lindsay, and bringing him on as kind of our director of research. He's worked with us on a ton of other formulas. Absolute genius. But then we also launched with a second product, Smart Caffeine, because we wanted people to know that we were a bigger play, that the idea of what we wanted to do in supplements, what we want to do in health and wellness is a lot bigger than just, you know, one product, which I think is how a lot of people start.
What are some of the challenges of a supplement business? Because when I talk with Amazon sellers, all I hear is horror stories.
Well, we haven't really gotten in any kind of trouble on Amazon or anything like that. But a lot of what you see there are going to be private label formulations that rely on, you know, fancy graphics or however it might work. And, you know, they're trying to, you know, game the system with, you know, whatever the reviews and things like that. Outside of that world, we're kind of more of a traditional brand, whereas we're sold in retail stores and places like that, you know, supplement shops. We do a lot of things that like a boring, you know, old company would do, like having a sales division and not focusing all of our efforts into the online side. But I think the main challenge in supplements is you're competing in an ultra, ultra competitive market where a lot of people are doing some shady, not so, you know, right things. And it's hard to really get the consumer's attention when you're competing against, you know, 30, 40, 50 other products.
So how are you doing that?
I think we do a lot of ours by one, being open, being transparent, and then two, we kind of want to be like Red Bull and tell a story. So when you drink Red Bull, automatically you think of like, whether it's the Flutog or the extreme athletes, and the skydivers, whatever it might be. So we want to create that, you know, experience and associate that with our brand. One of the things we did last year was, you know, we sponsored Martin Jacobson at the World Series of Poker. You know, he ended up winning. And what's amazing from all that is like you couldn't get a better story. This guy played from last place to ended up winning two marathon, you know, 12-hour sessions in a row. You know, what does he need more than anything? You know, focus and attention. And the products that we sell at Natural Stacks are all designed to help optimize, you know, mental performance. So when we look at marketing, we're looking to do big brand things that have a big impact. And we haven't always done it right, but, you know, we're learning as we go along, and we want to keep doing bigger and bigger things.
So you spoke a little bit about offline sales too. What percentage of your sales is offline versus online? Because I see a lot of people just focusing on online all the time, and I think you mentioned you're not, but I'm just curious about the offline part.
You might see it's really going to fluctuate from month to month, but maybe 30% is offline. And that's without really a division of a really robust sales division in-house. And now that we've brought someone in, we're going to keep deploying resources there. You know, we expect that to grow considerably. Of course, dealing with retailers, there are tons of challenges there. You know, a lot of them are going to want terms. They're going to want, you know, X amount of samples divided to X amount of stores. If you're in supplements, whatever other industry, they're going to want to make sure you got proof of insurance and all these things that a lot of people starting out don't necessarily have. Retail offline sales are a much bigger investment, but in my opinion, they're more defensible. And if someone's going to buy your business, it can be very attractive.
What's something that you encounter that you couldn't foresee before, but it's been a challenge in this whole business?
One of the biggest challenges that we face is international shipping. Because with Amazon and with everything else out there, people are used to getting their products quickly. When you buy a supplement most of the time it's for desired, you know, effect or benefit. It's something that you want immediately. And it's hard for us from time to time if something gets, you know, stuck in customs for like 2 weeks or 3 weeks, customers like waiting. And then, you know, we have to send another, or maybe we have to refund them. It's just like, unless we we have really two options. One, we can eat the price of, you know, more expensive shipping, or we could pass it on to the customer. Or I guess we have a third option of expanding, you know, globally into other fulfillment warehouses. But that's a big challenge for us, because so much of what we do at Natural Stacks is we all always focus on customer experience. We want to be so customer centric and make sure that everything from taking the product to all of their interactions with us are amazing. And if we can't create that, I get mad. It keeps me up at night. So for our international customers out there, we're working on making the process better.
I know it can't be easy for you too. I remember getting protein from the States in Japan, and I think the protein cost me like five times more than normal. And I remember ordering something in Thailand and in Europe, and the customs, I had to pay like $150 extra on top of whatever came. And the shipping time is varied too. Something came in like 5 days and the other thing came in like a month and a half. And I know it's not your fault, but it's insane.
Yeah, the supplement laws are, you know, vary significantly from one place to another. Like, for example, in Japan, you're allowed to order 3 months worth of personal use as long as it's coming from outside of the country. But let's say I wanted to sell there, like actually inside the country, you have to go through all the regulations, change all the labeling, et cetera, et cetera. It's got to get approved. But, you know, it's funny that they have like such a stringent process. But then, you know, if you want to order something just from outside of Japan, you're basically allowed to bring anything in. And you see that vary so much from one place to another. Australia has very strict regulations. Canada has very strict regulations. Germany does as well. So it's been a challenge, not always a fun one, but something we're working at getting better at.
Yeah, I was wondering if you use any of the fulfillment centers of Amazon in some of these other countries, or are you just only strictly shipping from the U.S.?
We're strictly shipping from the U.S. at this time. We are looking to expand, and I think that's going to be vital for us, you know, growing our business going forward. But it really depends on, you know, what markets we want to go after. And at the same time, we've barely even touched the surface. I hate to use a cliche like that, scratch the surface of the potential here in the States. But it's like, you don't need to be an international business to be, you know, doing $100 million, $200, $300, $400, $500 million a year.
I agree. And at the same time, you know, you are a pretty small business, even though it is making money. So the budget is probably pretty small too, especially compared to these other huge supplement brands. So how do you figure out what you're going to focus on? Because you can't put your money everywhere like some of those big brands, because you will run out of it before they do.
Absolutely. And this gets back to really being customer centric. It's like, if someone decides that they're going to spend a dollar, they're going to spend $42, they're going to spend whatever amount of money with us, you know, we want to treat them like gold. Introduce them to our brand, or onboard them with, you know, our company values, you know, what we're trying to achieve. Because if we let people like that go, then we're doing a bad job. And then we're also throwing money away in our marketing. So whatever we're doing, whether it's, you know, Facebook ads, whether it's, you know, content that we're creating, if someone purchases, you know, we want to treat them so special that they keep coming back and, you know, tell their friends.
What are some ways that you're doing that? How do you make someone that buys a supplement feel special?
I think it's really paying attention and delivering a personal touch whenever you can. So, for example, we had an order come in probably last week. Notice it was shipped to a hotel address versus like the regular address. So immediately we got on the phone, called the customer, and we said, you know, hey, Tom, I just wanted to see, you know, when you're going to be checking in at this address and when you're going to be checking out. You know, our shipping dates are going to vary from this time. We want to make sure that you get your package, because if not, you know, we can send it to another address, whatever it might be. It ended up this customer like got it sent there like a week before he's going to even leave or something like that. So it all worked out. But, you know, doing that building real experiences between the customer and our brand, even though we're like, you know, mainly distributed online, is really, really powerful, because I don't think other companies are doing that. But if you have an opportunity, whatever business you have, to make something personal, to deliver that extra amount of service, it'll really go a long way.
It sounds like you're doing something that CD Baby and Derek Sivers were doing before, getting in touch with that customer and doing like stuff that's just not, I guess, normal for online businesses. So I think you can do that, but it's just for supplements. I felt like it's more, I don't know if people pay that much attention, because it's like, you know, I get my supplement, I'm taking it, I do the workout. I don't feel a connection with it that much.
Yeah, and I don't necessarily know if that's right or wrong, but it's something that we're trying to overcome and really build that relationship to the customer, because ultimately if they like our products and they keep buying it, you know, their lifetime value is going to dramatically increase. And that's what we're trying to do for anyone that comes in and buys any of our stuff.
You mentioned sponsorships before. How much attention are you putting in that direction? Because that one you said was a winner, that's a poker player, but you know, there's other different types of sports out there. I don't know if they'll work as good.
Yeah, sponsorships are something that I really want to get involved with at a higher level, but I'm really unsure how to measure the ROI. And especially because, like what we talked about earlier, it's like, you know, we are a very small company. We have a very small marketing budget. We need to be extremely smart about where we deploy, you know, our capital. And we work with a few smaller athletes and help with some travel costs, and they help promote us and things like that. And it brought like customers in, but it's challenging now. It's something that I actually shifted one of our marketing people towards, really figuring out the brand ambassador thing and building that process and that part of the business and really adding automation to it. So I don't have the answer yet, but I like sponsorships. I want to do more. I'm not sure how to make it work.
Since we are on the topic of marketing, what other strategies are you using that seem like they're worthwhile?
Marketing-wise, a lot of what we're doing right now is kind of going through a rebuild where we're like, what are the things we want to focus on? Do we want to get the average cart value up? Do we want to get the reorder rates up? And building in better data into our business, because a lot of things right now are based on feel and like, oh, this feels right, let's do it. Oh, this feels right, let's do it. We're going back, we're reorganizing, kind of creating divisions, whether it's like subscription revenue, whether it's wholesale revenue, it's, you know, our combo packs. And we're building that out with KISS metrics and getting better, more actionable data. So that way with our advertising campaigns, whether it's, you know, Facebook, something like that, you know, we can scale all of those up and have a better idea of what happens when a customer comes in. Because right now, you know, there's different email funnels and upsells and things like that, but it's kind of all like, oh, this was a good idea, let's do it. This was a good idea, let's do it. Now we're getting back and we're breaking down the psychology of, okay, if someone comes in, they buy our vitamin D, $14.95. You know, where do we move them next? What is the next message that we should show them? Or what is the next thing we should tell them? And previously, they were all treated the same, you know, if they buy something for the first time. So it's getting back to the psychology, delivering, you know, an awesome experience. And like I said before, you know, treating anyone who decides to spend any amount of money with us, you know, just giving them, just wowing them.
You're selling someone vitamin D, and I guess the message is to keep staying away from the sun and keep buying the vitamin D.
Well, it's definitely something you need to take in the winter.
Or move to Portland. So there should be a little, like a brochure, like why Portland is so great. I heard there's like a huge vitamin D deficiency out there.
I have never been to Portland, but I think right now a ton of people are going for world domination or whatever.
Yeah, I went there last year and I spoke with the locals and they said it's like the main problem, it's the vitamin D deficiency. So it seems like a perfect market for you.
Well, I have to tell my sales team, get on the phone.
Have you had any success with Facebook ads for selling supplements? Because it's like the new hot thing now. Everyone's talking about Facebook ads. Forget AdWords and all this other stuff. Just, you know, Facebook ads all the way.
We've had some marginal success with Facebook ads. I'm very wary to say it's been like amazing, game changing or anything like that. I don't think any of those things are going to like hack it for us and allow us to like really like move forward significantly. I think like Facebook ads, most of the advertising things are just you know, things you kind of have to do to kind of move along, but they're not going to give you that giant exponential bump. And I'm sure I'm wrong because some people can do it and figure that out, but that's just like not my skill set. I'm more of like a brand building guy. So if you're an awesome Facebook guy and you know all the answers, please get in touch with me.
What do you think would hack it for you other than, let's say, a Walmart purchase order?
I don't think it would be a Walmart purchase order, but it would be doing some sort of exclusive distribution deal with like a Whole Foods or something like that, where we can introduce a line into a number of their different stores and really build that relationship between people, whether it's through in-store demos and things like that. One of the companies that I look at a lot as a reference point is called Vega. And I believe they sold for $500 million on less than $100 or maybe $100 million in revenue. They had, you know, really big distribution through traditional channels. I look at that as being seeing like what the big companies want. But then at the same time, we're trying to build something sustainable for the long term. We're kind of hitting all of the angles.
Yeah, before we finish up, I want to shift gears a little bit. What's your take on Shark Tank and the startup industry as a whole?
I think right now it's such an exciting time because people are just realizing that if you want to do a product, you can make a product. If you want to get an app built, you can build an app. And there are ways to monetize these things, you know, easily, whether it's a hobby or whatever it might be. I also think people need to take it with like a little bit of hesitation because it's like, it's not that easy. There are nights when you're going to be working your ass off and you're going to be, you know, upset that you can't do other things. There's going to be like problems that like feel like your head is going to explode for a couple of days until you get resolved. You're going to send out proposals to people. They're not going to get back to you. And you're just going to be like waiting to make sure your cash flow is okay. I mean, whatever it might be, it's like there's a lot of glitz and glamour out there, which I guess there always has been. But now I think it's portrayed a little bit more through social media and stuff like that. But this thing isn't always fun. That said, I'm like so blessed and so lucky and so thankful to be where I am. But it's like, man, there are times when you're just like in a dark place, like, oh, don't talk to me. I don't want to get off the couch. I'm like, but you got to pull yourself out of that and keep moving on.
We all go through these stages. When we first start a business, we're really reactive. So when something good happens, we're like, yeah, let's celebrate. And then something bad happens. And we're like, okay, let's curl up on the floor now. And then after you do that for a while, like, especially like with me, what I see is when something's going really well, like I know something bad's about to happen. So I don't even celebrate. But when something bad's happening, I'm like, you know, it's going to get good. So I feel like I'm like the opposite these days because I know it's all going to change. I just don't know when.
And once you get further along in this, it's kind of like you get tempered to the point where it's like, things are like going really well. Like sales are up, all these things are happening. And you kind of get less excited because you know, one, something bad's gonna happen and like the next day your sales will be like 50 bucks or something like that. And your main client will quit. But yeah, you gotta like just fight the resistance, keep going and just realize that we get to do something that, you know, most people dream of and, you know, be happy.
So where can people reach out to you and find you if they wanna do that?
My website is benhebert.com. I'm also at Twitter at ben_hebert.com. And if you want to email me, that's easy to find too.
Cool. So I'll put this in the show notes too. And I hope people don't bug you too much because that could happen.
Well, if they want to, I'm always here, always open.
Thanks for listening to the Smart Brand Marketing Podcast with Tom, the Digital Architect, Lee Bell. For more tips, tricks, and interviews, come visit smartbrandmarketing.com. That's smartbrandmarketing.com. And join the newsletter. It's free.